You know our slogan around here is better practice, better life. But we're taking this belief to the next level. And we've recently announced the creation of a new association. It's called the Best Practices Association. Our association celebrates the mindset that is better practice, better life. This mindset celebrates time, healthy living, personal growth, clinical excellence, and impacting the lives of your patients and your team through intentional leadership. In fact, we are the work-life balance experts in dentistry. The BPA will coach independent dental practices like yours to thrive by sharing best practices and operational habits, behaviors, systems, tools, and insight that lead to profitability and sustained growth, and you can still have a life. So if you're a dentist that wants to surround yourself with great thinkers, let us help you create your own version of better practice, better life. Go to actdental.com/BPA or hit the link in the show notes.
Hey guys, you're watching the Best Practices Show, where we take a look at the best business practices from the best dental practices all across the country. And if you're in this profession long enough, you're going to sell your practice, you're going to buy a practice, or you might even consider a partnership. And the statistic I've always heard is that 70 to 90% of partnerships fail and some of the sales go bad. And we're going to talk to the guy who helps you do the opposite, makes these sales successful, David Cohen. You're not going to want to miss this. So do me a favor, grab a pen and hit the share button. We'll see you in a second.
The Best Practices Show with Kirk Behrendt is brought to you exclusively by Act Dental, the ultimate provider of dental practice management solutions for dentists and their teams. Act Dental is committed to helping you build a better practice and a better life. If you are looking to grow your production, motivate your team, get back on track, and create the practice you've always dreamed about, look no further. Give us a call at 800-851-8186 or visit us at actdental.com.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Best Practices Show. We are having so much fun, again, shooting all of these and getting so much great feedback about the stuff that you want to see. So keep sending it to us and we're going to make it happen. One of the suggestions we get all the time is, how do we create a better relationship in dental partnerships, or the details of a sale, or the details of an actual purchase of a practice? And I have got the guy, the expert, he's actually my attorney, on today, and this is going to be so much fun. Now, before we jump into it, I have a couple show notes that I want to remind you of. We are shooting this live on Facebook. So as you have questions, please type them into the feed, and I'm going to make sure that we get you the right answers to your questions, because I want this to be hugely valuable to you as you watch these episodes. And we like the questions so much that every week we're giving away a free Apple iWatch. These things are awesome, with two free tickets to Activate, which is our practice growth seminar. So check it out. You're not going to want to miss this. But my guest today, I'm going to do my intro before I get David to talk. I've known David for a long time. We have actually known each other through the Seattle Study Club Network and Symposium. And I've known you for quite a long time. And you are just top-notch, rock solid. And so as my business has grown, you've been there, you know, side by side with me the whole time, just helping me make sure I cover, dot all of my I's and cross all of my T's. And I love how you work with so many other super high quality practices in minimizing the stress of these partnerships and sales. But if somebody doesn't know you, who is David Cohen? What's your story, brother?
Yeah, so my story is I'm David Cohen, and I specialize in helping dentists and specialists from a legal business transactional standpoint. And we work with clients all over the country with their transactional matters. And what transactional matters mean is contracts, essentially, purchases and sales of practices, and drafting and reviewing the contracts in connection therewith. Associateship agreements, bringing in associates to practices and reviewing associate agreements on behalf of doctors that are maybe going into associateships, and also partnerships, drafting and reviewing partnership agreements, and then working on real estate transactions with leases and purchases of buildings in connection with those transactions. I actually grew up in dentistry. My father is a periodontist, and as Kirk sort of alluded to, started a continuing education network called Seattle Study Club. And so from a young age, I grew up knowing dentists and specialists as part of my family. And I knew that despite not wanting to follow the path of being a dentist, I wanted to revert back to dentistry. And playing college basketball all the way through college, there was a point where I realized I wasn't going to the MBA and I had to do something else. And so I went into law and found a way to connect law back to dentistry. And that's really a brief synopsis of the story of how I got into the dental realm from a legal standpoint.
Yeah, and your father's been an incredible mentor of mine, and the network, CL Study Club, just incredible and just incredible. So if you haven't been, you got to go. Now, David, let's talk about why this is so important, you know, before we get into the details of the how, because I'm a big fan of really understanding all of it before you get into the actual recipe. Partnerships fail for a lot of different reasons. And you work with very successful partnerships and you work hard to make sure they're successful. But as you run into partnerships that have failed, why are the reasons? Why is this topic so important and why do they fail?
That's a good question. And I hear all the time that partnerships do have a high fail rate. And I've definitely seen some failures of partnerships. The key that I help with is being proactive from the beginning, right, and making sure that the partners actually, first and foremost, have a partnership agreement in place. Believe it or not, there are numbers of partnerships nationwide that do not actually have partnership agreements. And those that do sometimes don't have all of the provisions that they should probably have in them. So the first key from a legal standpoint is making sure that the doctors have a partnership agreement and B, an adequate partnership agreement. And partnership has three phases. It has how to get into the deal, how to operate through the deal, and how to get out of the deal. And getting into the deal typically is going to begin with a purchase and sale, which we can get to later in this conversation today. But the partnership typically is going to have a partnership agreement that governs how you operate through, and then equally important, how you get out of the deal. And right. So it's really important that we be proactive from the beginning to make sure that all of the material points are outlined between the parties to diminish the chance to have disagreements or issues down the road. Believe it or not, I think there's a myth that partnerships break up a lot of times because of money. Mm-hmm. And so before I even get to the partnership path, and before we talk about getting into the deal, operating through the deal, and getting out of the deal, one of the biggest reasons why I see partnerships break up is not necessarily money in the operation through the deal. It's actually personality. And personality is the key reason why I see partnerships not succeed. And I'm highly recommending to clients personality testing, which is outside the legal realm, but something really important as doctors build their teams, which we can chat about later, and I think is really important to make sure that the personalities are compatible. Now, the tests aren't 100% accurate, but I think dentists would be very surprised at how accurate they can be. And those can help in going into the partnership to seeing if the personalities are the right fit.
Right. This is so good because I have so many questions. Now, I found in my experience, partnerships can be quite emotional. People remember only what they want to remember sometimes. And we do say this, I'm sure it's highly applicable. If it isn't in writing, then it doesn't exist. I'm actually shocked that people create business partnerships without any type of an agreement. And the third one that you mentioned is one of the most critical. You don't design a partnership if it's going to dissolve. You design it when it's going to dissolve, because I've seen fathers and sons go into business together and that goes bad. Or you have two dentists that sat next to each other in dental school and say, we're going to do this because we love each other. You know, you have to design it that when we're done, this is how it works, correct?
Correct. Absolutely. So my job is to be proactive from the beginning and make sure that the parties have an adequate agreement that governs all of the material points that the clients have agreed to, so that it minimizes the chance to have ambiguity and vagueness later. And ambiguity and vagueness can cause disputes. Now, the best partnerships that I ever see are those that sign the agreement and they never pick it up ever again. Those are the best partnerships. And I think personality testing, knowing each other, working together on the front end can also be really good tools to make sure that you have a successful partnership But once you've done that, it's still really important to have all of the material points governed in the agreement, just in case there's a question or dispute. And then the parties can come back to each other and say, yeah, you know, I may not agree with what I agreed to prior, but I know that I agreed to it and it's right in writing and I signed off on it. And so that's just the way that it needs to be. And so that's why it's really important to have stipulations in the contract that protect both sides, that are fair for everybody and that they've already agreed to. So there's no ambiguity.
Right. Now go back to the personality testing too, because there's so many of them. You've got Myers-Briggs, you've got DISC, you've got Colby, you've got all strengths finders. Do you find there's a particular testing process that has been more predictable than others? And then why is it so important to understand your personality style of your partner? And I think I know the answer to that question, but I want to hear from you.
Yeah, you know, I don't have a particular go-to as far as which test seems to be more successful than others. I've actually found that most of the clients that go do them, whichever they use, seems to work pretty well. Right. I haven't heard much negative feedback on any of those, but I do think great resources like yourself and consultants that know a lot of different parties out there that do the personality testing, they can talk to, or as well as me, to decide what might be the best fit for them. A lot of times when people use a service, it's not always who's the best in the industry for somebody else, it's who's the best for them. And so they get a great opportunity to interview them and see what might be best.
Right. So let's jump right into it. You know, when you're looking at buying a practice, what are some of the considerations? Because you take the legal jargon a lot of times when you do seminars and you're a great speaker, taking all the legal jargon out of it so that a dentist who's watching it can understand about some considerations in buying a practice. What would you say?
So you're asking, what would I say as far as somebody who's looking to buy a practice?
Yeah. What are some of the simple considerations you want to take into account when you're buying a practice?
So yeah, that's a really good question. We have clients that will buy a practice for the first time. Mm-hmm. And we have clients that are now looking to buy multiple practices to add to the current locations that they have. And the principles are really the same. Number one, they want to look at their structure of their business. And this is particularly important for those that are adding additional locations to their practices, as far as how do they want to legally structure the deal to make it work optimally for them. So let's say a doctor has a current practice and they're looking to buy another location. One of the biggest considerations they have from a legal standpoint is, do they keep the current corporation or type of business entity that they own to then purchase the additional location with, or do they form a brand new one? And there are positives and negatives to both routes. And I typically take my clients through the positives and the negatives. The positives to forming another entity typically are that you can separate the practices from a liability standpoint. And also, if you're looking to grow, sometimes you're looking to bring in future partners. And oftentimes, you may not want a future partner owning all of your practices. Maybe you just want them owning one location. And to set up a brand new business for another location would more easily allow them to bring a partner in to, say, that location, but not have them also have to be a partner in the current location that they have. So separating liabilities, creating more flexibility to have future partners that can help run these practices is a huge advantage to forming a different business entity. The obvious downfalls are that it's more administrative work and legal in time and more tax returns, obviously, to have multiple entities. And then obviously the huge consideration is the clients have to understand what state they're in and what the laws in their state dictate as far as how many practices they can have and under what circumstances, et cetera. So generally, those are the pros and cons, but also the law is going to also help dictate what the structure is. And that's why it's good to chat with an attorney who knows dental, sets these things up so that they can know in their state, in their situation, what's best.
Right, right. And I'm just going to say this. If you're a dentist and you're going to practice for a very long time, don't ever consider ever doing this without the help of a professional. That is just, I don't care what it costs you. It's worth every penny and 10 times more, because most of these partnership decisions are fueled emotionally, and it becomes a hot mess later on. Now, I've got to ask you some tough questions on partnerships. Sure. I've always heard this. When you're buying a practice, you never want to have the same person representing both sides. You want to have opposite parties. Can you just talk about that? Whether it be a broker or anything like that. I mean, give us some simple advice that you want to consider when buying a practice.
Yeah, the main reason why you may have heard it's not a good idea for the same party to represent both sides is because it's what we call a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. And what that means is if a party can't zealously represent their client, if they're also representing the other client. And so it can cause a conflict of interest. So it is an important recommendation that I give often in my transactions, if I can give a recommendation, that each side have their own representation through the process.
Right. And then the other thing that comes up a lot of times, now I've heard this, but I'm going to ask you, the expert. I've heard from so many people, it is never, ever a good idea to create a 50-50 partnership. Never. Someone is going to have to earn their way up to the 50-50, because when you think about it, if you're the owning dentist or owning person that created the entity, you never want to offer half of the equity up front. But you tell us, is that true? Is that not true? Tell me your thoughts.
I think that's true in some circumstances, and I think 50-50 can actually work in other circumstances. I think a big part of it depends on how, usually these partnerships and the getting in process start with a purchase. And usually that purchase is not always, but usually maybe a less experienced doctor that is coming into a more experienced doctor's practice. And so usually it's not 50-50 because that less experienced partner typically doesn't produce at the same levels right. as the more experienced doctor. And so, and I recommend that the percentage ownership be based upon what levels the doctors really can produce at. So right. if you have doctors that can produce at that same level, I don't think 50-50 is it necessarily a bad thing or something to be afraid of. I think that it's something that can work, and that a doctor who is producing at that 50-50 level would probably mandate, or they wouldn't necessarily want to buy in. And so accommodation is important too. I just think it can work depending on the circumstances. So yeah, I wouldn't say that it doesn't work 50-50. I think it definitely can, but I would think that the parties have to be on the same page, and the parties have to be producing at a pretty equal level to do that.
Right, right. And so that was my next question. And that's why we ask the experts, because I'm not an expert in this field at all. Is the whole term eat what you kill as a partnership? Because here are some of the pitfalls I see. Partnership starts well intended, and then the new dentist comes in and they can't produce anywhere to the level that the selling dentist is in. There's a disparity. Now there's also disparity. Sometimes you talked about personality, or just weird stuff can happen. But let's talk about compensation, because that tends to be one of the hottest topics that ends up, creating problems. Do you suggest an eat what you kill formula? And are there any things as simple rules that you use when starting this?
So I'll start with my lawyer answer, in that every circumstance is a little bit different.
Right. So,
but I will say this. I think that if it's an investment practice where we just talked about a doctor who may open up another location, oftentimes that other location is an investment location because the doctor, would be spreading themselves too thin to try to be in different places at the same time. And so with investment locations, often I think splitting the money based on percentage ownership does work, because the parties aren't typically working in those practices. It's more of just an equity ownership sharing dynamic. If the doctors are actually practicing in the practices, I do typically highly recommend that the doctors base the distributions and the pay on how they produce. Now, the question, and you alluded to this, because if you don't, and let's say you have 50-50 partners and one's producing at a massively high level and the other's at a lower level, then the one producing at the lower level is not incentivized to practice or to produce more, because they're getting more and doing less. And the doctor who's producing more is not incentivized to optimize their potential either, because the harder they work, they're still getting less. And so right. In the end, it creates a scenario where the practice isn't optimized as far as potential is concerned, and that's not usually a good formula. And so, yes, production-based model, I think, does work. Now, the question is, Do you do a strictly production-based model, or do you have some carve-outs? There are definitely some theories where you can carve some money out for that is based on percentage ownership. So the parties have something known coming in, which is really important for business owners from a cash flow standpoint, to know that they have some money coming in that's certain and not based on their production, particularly for maybe a young buyer who has to service debt for, say, a buy-in to the practice that they got a loan for. It's nice for them to know they can service that debt with a defined amount monthly, let's say monthly, and then the rest may be based on percentage of, you know, production, so to speak. So I think that hybrid model works. I think the total eat what you kill can work as well. And I think that the ownership split works as well if maybe it's an investment practices where the doctors aren't actually practicing. I do think it's dangerous unless the doctors are producing at pretty much the exact same levels, just split based on ownership, if the doctors are actually practicing in the practice.
Right. I'm going to ask you the tough questions because I get these questions and I don't have answers for them. So if it's okay, I'm going to dish them to you. We've always heard when a young dentist buys a mature practice and the dentist is there, that can be complications if the seller wants to be there for a very long time. Now, there are some consultants out there that recommend when you buy a practice, you exit the seller as fast as possible. Now, all of these circumstances can work, but can you talk about that? Because that can be a challenge when you have a seller that wants to hang on and not let the new purchaser start influencing the future of the direction. What do you recommend or what do you see when that starts to happen?
So you're talking about in let's say a walkaway sale where a buyer buys a practice, but then keeps the seller on as an associate for a certain period of time. Is that
what exactly? That's a perfect example.
Okay. So the typical period that I see and recommend is about a 1 year period because that allows the seller to be there to help transfer the goodwill to practice, which is a huge portion typically of what's being sold when a sale happens. But not so long that it hampers the buyer of the practice, because there could be issues over that period of time with the buyer feeling like the seller is interfering and getting in their business, but and acting like they maybe still own it when they don't own it anymore. And it's really the buyer's practice. And, you know, sellers sometimes get frustrated that the buyer is not running things the way that they would have liked to see. So there could be some issues. And so the shorter period of time usually allows the parties to accomplish what they want, but not have it so long that they could have prolonged issues. There are also termination provisions in these contracts, in associate contracts, that say, notwithstanding the fact that we have, let's say, a 1 year contract, either party can voluntarily terminate through the process with X days notice. And this is a dilemma that I see. A dilemma is a strong word. This is an item that I see that needs to be tackled in almost every sale and post-associateship. I always ask the client that I'm representing, do you want to have this as a locked-in associateship, or do you want the liberty to be able to get out of this if things aren't working out? Sometimes you have sellers that say, I'm not going to sell unless I can continue to work for X period of time because that's part of my plan. And sometimes you have sellers that say, I'm selling because I don't want to do this anymore. I'll stick around for you for a certain period that you need, but I really want to retire and stop practicing. And then sometimes you have buyers that want the seller out ASAP. And sometimes you have buyers that say, I need this seller in here to help me for X period of time. So every situation is different, but you have to define in the contract whether you're going to have that voluntary termination provision or not, and that makes sure that all parties are on the same page. And the biggest thing that I can recommend with this is proactively in advance, have open and transparent communication between the buyer and the seller so they're on the same page. If the seller is expecting to be locked in without being able to be terminated for a certain period of time, the buyer needs to know that. Or if vice versa, the seller needs to know that the buyer thinks otherwise, because otherwise you get down the road, you paid legal fees and you've spent time, money and energy, and then you get to a point that is so material and could be disagreed upon, and that can cause issues when you're trying to close a deal.
Yeah, we live by this in our company. Unstated expectations eventually become a conflict, and unresolved conflicts eventually become crisis. You know, so, you know, anything that isn't written, I think what you said was brilliant. It has to use the word define and contract, because David, it's crazy how much we see the opposite where, you know, I'll talk to a dentist at a study club or anything. They're like, I just bought this practice and I bought it from another dentist and they're staying. I go, well, how long? And they go, well, I don't know. And I'm like, wait, you don't know? You didn't discuss that? There's no provisions. They're like, yeah, he's going to stay until he's done. And I think that's very bad. I mean, that's just a formula for disaster. Everything has got to be written down, because I found also too, when it's in writing, there's no emotion. I mean, we're talking about a document here. It's a legal contract. And if we need David to interpret what we agreed on 3 years ago, we can do that, right? So that's key. And then the other thing, can you just talk about that? I'm sure you don't see that a lot. But I do see it a lot where it's undefined.
Yeah, you mean just the fact? Yeah, well, first and foremost, just like with partnership agreements, I see even more associates not have associate agreements.
Right.
So nothing is defined whatsoever. But kind of more speaking on your question, yes, I often do see that particular issue not be narrowly defined in the contracts. It might be addressed, but not as defined as elaborately as it should.
Right. Now, the other thing, when you also said the words all parties, I have to ask you about spouses, because while we can talk about the legal stuff, how important is it to have the spouses involved in these conversations? Because it's been my experience that two people can work together really well, but the spouses not being on the same page can exacerbate the whole thing. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it can be true. I think it depends on which spouses the parties are dealing with, how involved the spouses want to be. If the spouses want to be involved, I think it's critically important that they are a part of it and that they have the good relationship and it's amicable and at least they can work together. So it really depends on the spouses that are in question. But I do think from time to time that is important.
What if a dentist has multiple spouses? So that's a whole other deal.
Yeah, we'll that's a whole other thing. Yeah.
We're dealing with other things because, you know, and I want to speak to this, that it is truly a marriage. And this is our own show, so we can say whatever we want. But dentists always say it's a marriage without sex, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it's truly a marriage in all respects. I mean, you're two people that have to love and care for each other. You got to be on the same page. You've got people that you're responsible for. You have to treat it almost like parenting in that respect. Can you speak to the whole, it's a marriage, really?
Yeah, it absolutely is a marriage. And that's why I recommend the personality testing and to not go into these partnerships lightly. I have clients call me all the time and say they want to do a startup partnership. And I ask them how well they know the other person, and often they don't know them hardly at all, or maybe more dangerously, they know them extremely well from being good buddies, but they don't know how well they can work together in an actual business environment, in a business relationship. So I do think it is incredibly important to make sure that the parties are compatible.
Yeah. And I've heard this too. Two bulls in one ring will eventually kill each other. They just will. Yeah. So the personality style, where if you get two high D's, it's going to come to a head. So you need provisions, you need swim lanes, you need circumstances for how these two bulls are going to operate. I think ultimately one of them's got to give. And so you can help facilitate that process in writing, correct? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is it trickles down to other areas of the practices. So if, for instance, if you have if you have a senior doctor that's been in a practice for a while and they sell to a younger doctor who's come in with maybe less experience, their staff to deal with. And the staff is so used to dealing with the more experienced doctor that they've worked for a significant period of time, they're used to going to that doctor for decision making. And they have to get in the mode of going to everybody, going to all the owner doctors, because, you know, there's more than one owner at that point. And the senior doctor in that circumstance has to do a good job of making sure the staff knows that and that they gain the requisite respect to that younger doctor in that situation to make sure that everything's flowing, because relinquishment of that control is sometimes difficult for doctors that have more experience and been in the practice for a while. But it's really important to have that respect, because that also helps that relationship. And so, yeah, it trickles down to other areas of the practice. And then ultimately, if that there isn't that same level of respect from the staff, it not only is problematic at that particular time, but it also could be problematic when, say, the younger doctor buys out the more experienced doctor and it's their practice and they haven't built that same respect and rapport over the years. So it's not even just the relationship between the two parties at play. It's also trickles down to other areas of the practice and other relationships in the practice that could cause some issues as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's on the buying. Now let's talk about the selling side of things and simplifying some of these secrets. Help us understand, when is a dentist ready to sell? When are they not ready to sell? You know, the stock market changed everything for a lot of boomers saying, hey, look, I'm going to practice a little bit longer. Any advice you would give us about selling a practice, what time it is to sell a practice, and what you can expect from the sale of a practice?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that, so I recommend that doctors work with a team when they do anything. It's important to have a team. And one reason is doctors don't have the requisite time to put into it, even if they have requisite expertise in that particular area. But also, it's if they don't have that expertise, they shouldn't be doing things on their own. And so obviously, CPAs, financial planners are really important components of that team. So part of when a doctor is ready to sell depends on the financials. And are they in a financial position to make the decision to sell? Is the valuation of their practice and the money they would get, would that be enough for them to, let's say they're trying to retire, would that be enough to help them with their retirement plans, or do they need to continue to work? So the financial is definitely one of them. There are certainly a lot of other aspects to consider. Some doctors have physical issues with maybe back issues or with their hand or whatever it might be, which may cause them to know that this is the right time. And then the doctors also have to decide in what capacity do they want to sell and when is the right time to do that, such as do they want to take a step back, create their own little DSO, so to speak, model where they can own a bunch of practices and just manage them and have other doctors come in. So they're really not retiring, but they're selling out of sort of the dental side of things from their standpoint. Or do they just want to sell completely and stop practicing? So all these factors are just examples of ones that they should consider. But I think probably the main one when a doctor sells is the financial and whether it makes sense for them.
Right, right. And so I've heard this from a lot of people that have sold their practices. You have no idea how much money you spend when you're not working. Like, your burn rate is a lot higher than you think it is. People plan for, well, we live on this kind of money right now. Well, you're spending most of your week working. I spend a ton of money when I'm just on a Saturday going to Costco, whatever. I'm just getting out of bed is expensive. and then the other thing, I know this is a wild generalization and I know this wouldn't be spot on, but is it true that when you sell your practice, you're going to get about 1.5 times the net, or is that just too much of a generalization to use today in today's marketplace?
I think it's a little bit of a generalization because there's so many other factors to take into place. And I keep giving you these legal responses, but these lawyer type responses, but it's true. What type of practice is it? Is it a specialty office? Is it a GP? What type of practice is it? And who are you selling to?
Right.
A lot of practices now are selling to larger investment groups, dental service organization groups, venture capital groups. Those type of quote unquote corporate sales are going to give perhaps more money than your typical valuation would dictate. But there are also a lot of strings attached with that. And those type of sales cater to a particular type of person. They're great for some people. They're not as good for other people. And then you have your sale to, let's say, someone who's been in your practice, who's already, you've been partnering with them, or they're an associate and they know the practice. So a valuation may be different for somebody who's already been in the practice and maybe partnering with you versus evaluation to just sell it out outright completely. Based upon your teammates, the CPA, the financial planner that I just mentioned, those would be really good resources to talk to about valuations. And in your particular circumstance, what would be fair and reasonable? So I do think it differs. I don't think there's a hard and fast rule of X, Y, and Z is the exact type of numbers you should be looking at the value of practice.
Yeah, and that's I expected that answer, and I appreciate that a ton. Now, I get this question a lot, so I'm going to throw it at you too. Is let's say I've done what you're talking about, David. And I'm working with you, getting all these things in line. I figure I'm ready to go or get ready to start. Where do I start the transition process? Like, do I put in an ad? Am I going to be talking to the supply people? Because finding a younger dentist or a dentist coming to buy your practice, these demographics are changing and people aren't just knocking on your door going, hey, you ready to sell yet? So where would I start if I'm ready to sell?
So if you're ready to sell, a good place to start is to find a good consultant or broker who has a lot of different relationships with potential buyers, and they can help locate a buyer and find who might be the right fit for your practice or somebody in you. It also helps create some competition that may help with the value that you may want to sell for. Another great way is at the schools. Some of the doctors do lecturing at the schools. It's great to do like a lunch and learn for some of the schools. It's a great way to give back to the students and also build relationships to get to know some of the students and those that could potentially be candidates to come into the practice and work and be a partner or to buy you out completely. Those are the two ways that I see most in terms of a seller finding someone to buy their practice and actively list it transparently on the market.
Right. Now, I know you're in this business and you're a fabulous transition expert, but I'm going to say this. There are some people that don't have the best reputations. And for whatever reason, I do think there are some questions you should ask a broker. Here's one of mine. How long have you been brokering practices? Because I'm finding dentists that retire, they've been out of dentistry for a month and now they're professional brokers and they really don't know the legal logistics. I mean, you need to know the differences and changes that are affecting even with Delta Premier and Delta PP. I mean, there's massive changes in the landscape, and I'm finding young dentists are buying practices and they go, I just bought a Delta Premier practice. And I'm like, no, you didn't. And they didn't know that. And they oftentimes, if you really get down to the source of what happens, there was a person in the middle of this transaction that had no idea what they were talking about and put a buyer and a seller together. So anybody who's watching this that's considering selling a practice, what questions should you ask a broker that's looking to help you? What would be some of your questions that you would ask?
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. I think it's, you know, like any person that comes on your team, it's really critical to find someone who is good at what they do and who you feel like you have built a good relationship with. Key questions that I would ask brokers are, well, first of all, before even asking questions to the brokers, I would interview yourself. And the interview of yourself is going to consist of, what are you looking for in this transaction? I've had clients who have practices that are not the easiest to sell for whatever reason. And maybe because they're unique or they're in a certain area of the country where it's harder to get people to come to. And so their primary goal oftentimes is, I just need someone who can find me a buyer. And if they find me a buyer, they've exceeded their value or they've met the value that I needed in this deal. I have other clients that need their hand held some, that need somebody who can really be in the thick of it, in the trenches, and help even negotiate to a degree to bridge the gap, if there is a gap, with the buyer, communicate between attorneys. And by the way, I do recommend attorneys on both sides of deals where brokers are involved. That's another thing. That's actually one thing that should be asked of a broker is, do you draft the contracts? Do the attorneys draft the contracts? Right. And if brokers, there are some brokers that draft really good and fair contracts, nothing wrong with that. And then they let the parties get their own counsel, but it's important the parties get their own counsel on each side to then review that contract from the brokers. But the brokers can help bridge any gaps and be a facilitator, which can be very helpful. And they can also just, you know, there's various grunt work that has to be done in a sale process and contacting of landlords and, you know, many different parties that brokers can be really valuable for. So just to back up, I think the client has to interview themselves to decide what they're actually looking for and what their expectation is. And then once they've done that, they can ask the broker the questions. And you mentioned a couple. How long have they been doing it for? What is their objective through the process? Are they representing the other side too? There are some brokers out there that try to represent both sides, and that is a conflict of interest.
Right.
And conflict of interest can be disclosed and should be disclosed, and the parties can decide if they are comfortable with that or not. But they have to realize that a broker is going to get their commission if the deal happens, and they're not if the deal doesn't happen. And so you have to question, can they effectively represent both sides in a deal and have everyone be happy in the end? And the answer might be yes. The answer might be no. I typically say no, but it's not that it can't happen, but it's for the parties to decide. And so that's a key question. Would they be representing both sides? And I guess another key question would be what the broker's goals are in the transaction and what they plan to provide, what they plan to do for the client, and maybe have a list of things that they're going to do through the process.
Right. Yeah. Your answer would be maybe no. Mine would be every time no. Have, you know, no different than buying a house. If it's a house that you really, really want, do you want a real estate agent representing both sides saying, I talked to the seller, you know, I want somebody to go into battle and say, I want this and this, and they're going to, you know, go in there for all best intentions being on your side of things. And the other thing I wanted to ask you is, this is not a short process. When you talk about expectations, sometimes sellers of practice go, oh yeah, well, I'm going to engage, you know, this takes like a month or 2 months. What could we expect when you start to sell your practice? Now, I know it varies, but it doesn't take a month to pull this off. Sometimes it's going to be several months. It could be a year. I mean, you've got to be prepared that this is going to be, we've got to get all things in place. And it typically ends up being a longer process than most expect. True or false?
I think that's true. I would expect a 2 to 3 month process usually. And at a minimum, I would say, if you're starting from scratch and let's say you're a seller, you need to identify a broker, ask the great questions that we just had talked about, see if they're a good fit. They're going to have to then seek the buyer. Once they do, then the parties are going to have to get representation. The contracts are going to have to be drafted, which can take a few weeks. Once the contracts are drafted, they'll typically go to the client of who the drafter was representing, and the client reviews. Those parties get on the same page, and then that document will go to the other side. Usually the seller drafts, so usually it then goes to the buyer. The buyer then reviews and has their counsel review. And then there could be some negotiation, some back and forth in the process. And then we have the real estate component, particularly if a building is being sold, that there's due diligence involved with that and title work, and it can take a significant period of time. And even leases can take some time, particularly if you have a landlord that, say, is going to be assigning a lease that's already in place to a buyer. You have to make sure that the landlord is amenable to assigning the lease and getting them to sign off on it. And some landlords can take a long time to go through that process. So I'd say a minimum of 2-3 months would be the process. It can actually take longer. It can take 6 months. I've had deals that have taken a year. It's pretty rare, but it can. It can also take sooner if everybody's on the ball and on the same page and you have advisors on both ends that know dental. Knowing dental is really critical to have advisors know dental, because that actually expedites the process. So, you nailed it, Kirk. I think it does take some time, and clients do need to manage their expectations with that. And I think, you know, 2-3 month window is about a fair average, I would say.
Okay. And you got a great question here from Deepak, who asked, is a non-compete typically part of the sales process, a sale process legal documentation? If so, what would be some fair guidelines for a non-compete that courts would agree is fair and not too restrictive? Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I'm so glad that question was asked, because I think that non-competes are a critical component of sale documents. And what non-competes do is they say that the seller, after the sale, cannot compete with the buyer within certain parameters for a certain period of time and typically certain mileage. Although in some states like Louisiana, it's by a lot of times by parish, not mileage. So you have to know the state that you're in. And on that note, every state has different laws concerning non-competes, and some states allow them, some states don't. Some states allow them in certain circumstances and some don't. So first you have to determine, is a non-compete even legally enforceable in the state that you're in and under the certain circumstance that you have? For instance, some states, non-competes for associateships are pretty much unenforceable, but they are enforceable when a sale occurs and goodwill is being transferred. So to generally answer, I would say a lot of the parameter depends on what state that you're in. There's no such thing as, let's say, a 3-year, 10-mile non-compete standard. And I know there are banks out there that will say, we're not going to lend money unless you have a 3-year, 10-mile non-compete. Mm-hmm. But that's not always realistic. And sometimes you have to talk to a bank to make sure that they understand the law, because the law is different in every state. And the law typically in most states, not every state, most states says the parameters have to be the smallest that can legitimately protect the buying party without prejudice to the selling party, which just means in English, it has to be reasonable. And so if you're in the middle of New York City, and I just talked about this in a lecture I just did, Seattle Study Club Symposium. If you're in the middle of New York City, a 10-mile radius is not going to be reasonable. Mm-hmm. So a bank that requires that, you're going to have a tough time in trying to negotiate that. Whereas if you're in the middle of rural Texas, 30 or 40 could be deemed reasonable if most of the patients, say, come from that mile radius. So I don't know what state Deepak is in, but whatever state that you're in, I'm always happy to be a resource. If you wanted to give me a ring, I can tell you about what I think in the state that you're in and what might be viable. But it really depends. It's on a state-by-state basis, but you're going to want to, it's usually a reasonableness standard based on the circumstances.
Yeah, he just said, I'm in Texas. So
Texas is a reasonability standard. And so you'd have to look at typically the smallest parameters that could legitimately protect you if you're buying without prejudice to the selling party. Now, it's harder to argue prejudice to a selling party for someone that just took a bunch of money in a sale and sold a lot of quote unquote goodwill. But not every seller is ready to finish practicing, and they may not intend to compete with you, but they still may want to make a living. And so you have to have a balancing act and put those factors in play when you make that determination.
Yeah, great question. Great answer. Thank you guys very much. Now, we've talked about the buying, talked about the selling. What simple secrets or simple guidelines would you give to longstanding partnerships that you've noticed? You know, if you were to simplify the recipe and say, look, the partnerships that I see that work really well, they probably have three things or four things. What would you say are standards for a healthy dental partnership?
So how you operate through and how you get out of the deal, and operating through, the two key things I would mention are management decision making. So are you going to base it on majority voting or unanimity? How are you going to make decisions together? If you're 60-40, are you still going to vote unanimously because you're both owners of the practice? Are you going to base decisions based on percentage ownership because one party owns more than the other? So decision making is critical to identify as you go through and operate through the deal. Number two is how you split the money, how you split the cost. And we talked earlier in this session about that and about examining your circumstance. Are you in an investment situation? Are you in a situation where you're actually going to practice? Talking to your teammates, your financial team, and your lawyers to decide in your circumstance, how would it be best to split the money? If you're going to do a production-based model, is it going to be a total eat-what-you-kill model? Or is it going to be based on maybe carving out a certain known sum of money that comes into the parties every month? So operating through, those are the two main things that I would look for. And then in getting out of the deal, you have to govern voluntary transfer. You have to govern death, disability, if the parties disagree, and default. So there's five things to look for in getting out of a deal. Those are really important because when partnerships break up, you have to have clear guidelines as to how to get out of the deal. And that's probably the least governed area of these contracts and the most important area. Death is typically governed by life insurance. Disability, it's really critical to make sure you're defining what really consists of disability and how you're going to buy somebody out when that happens. Default, you know, what consists of a default? If someone loses their license or they commit a felony or something like that. Those would be examples of defaults.
Right.
And then, as far as just transferring interest is concerned, when can a party do that? Do you want to place limitations on when they can do that? Like if you just get into a partnership, it's probably not a good idea to let someone just abandon ship and leave. So you may want to push some limitations and say no one can retire for 2 or 3 years. Right.
Right.
And retiring doesn't just mean stopping practicing dentistry. It could just mean transferring the interest in the practice. So, you know, speaking very generally without going on and on, you know, I do lectures for an hour or two on this. Those are the main things to look for to make sure you have in those contracts.
Right. And even in those three, that's brilliant because you can see the ambiguity that would lend itself to a tremendous amount of conflict. And number three, I'll keep going to that. Number three is often the most difficult one. We had a young dentist who was in a partnership, and I don't know what you call this, but they committed a felony. It's called a certain clause. And unwinding that was just a disaster for him because it wasn't outlined. And then it just becomes a mess. He did very well once he was out of it. But in even death, unfortunately, we've seen it a few times where the dentist will die and then the spouse reacts in a very unreasonable way. And it's not outlined and it just becomes more of a mess. So you really do want to cover every possible circumstance. That's why working with a professional is like a non-negotiable item. Now, other things as far as the behavioral health of the practice, because these are the legal, you know, very important decision-making thing. But how do you keep a partnership strong even after you've done all these things? Do you recommend a certain, you know, regular cadence that they communicate on a weekly basis? Because I've seen partnerships that last because they don't talk. You know, that's extremely dysfunctional. What are some other characteristics you see just behaviorally that lend itself to a great partnership?
So, like I mentioned a few minutes ago, I think the best partnerships are those where they sign the agreement and never have to pick it up again. That right. said, that should not be misconstrued to mean that they don't talk or don't have certain, weekly meetings or monthly meetings or, you know, different things to make sure they're in constant communication, because those are actually things that help them not have to pick up that document. Right. And so I see doctors have one meeting per week. And I think that really helps as far as getting on the same page with what's going on in the practice and what can be done to improve and what's going on that's positive in the practice. Sometimes that's not completely realistic, and maybe they do it every 2 weeks, or at least I recommend at least once a month to have that kind of meeting, and just to make sure that you're going over all issues and getting things out on the table. And, you know, that could also include talking about the staff, of course, and making sure that the staff's on the same page and seeing if you have to make any tweaks. So it's a great question. I think it is really important to have the constant communication to make sure that things are smooth.
Amen, brother. Amen. And you and I, we talked about this before we got started. You're going to help us with a whole nother big subject, which is associateships, because that has a whole lot of nuances and details to it. And we're going to cover that in a whole nother show. We're going to do a 2-part series here. But this is awesome, David. I'm so grateful and great information. So if you're watching this and you're considering a purchase, a sale, or partnership, please reach out to a professional and get some help. Don't do it on emotion. Don't do it because you think it's a great idea. It can start as a great idea, but you're going to need the help of a great team to make sure that it stays a great idea. So, David, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, how can I get a hold of you?
3 different ways. Number one, the website, which is www.cohenlawfirmpllc.com. So www.cohenlawfirmpllc.com is the website.
And we put a link in there. There's a link in the post there, so you can just click on it.
And then, you know, there's a phone number on the website, which is 972-379-7513. And there is an email address, which is David@CohenLawFirmPLLC.com. And I'd love to be a resource. If you have any questions, I'm not the type of firm that is going to charge you for every second to just chat and see what's going on and see if we can help, if we can't help. And we work with clients all over the country, and just happy to be a resource and chat. No problem.
Yeah, you're not just a resource, you're a tremendous resource. I could say this, you're one of the hardest working kids I know. I call you a kid because you're one of me, but everything I ever need, it's like you hammer it out and you're there for me. And I really appreciate that, buddy. So thank you for being on today. And so if you're watching this again, please type in the questions. There are a couple of good questions already today. If you're watching this after the live feed, ask them and David will get back to you, and because we want to make sure that your questions are answered. So David, stay on for just a second. But if you're watching the Best Practice Show, again, we're so grateful you're watching. Please continue to give us feedback about shows that you want to see, and I will make it happen. And until we see you next time, keep watching the Best Practice Show. Have a great day, everybody.